Hi, this is Ken Rimple of Chariot Solutions. Welcome to the Philly Emerging Tech Podcast number 2 for 2011. This one is Mark Chadwick, Chief Architect at Invite Media of Google. Mark's talk is called Doing the Mundane a Million Times a Minute. And from his abstract, over the course of 3 years, Invite Media built a high-volume system for serving online advertisements from the ground up. Some of the more interesting challenges revolved around operating routine services at scale, such as distributing requests, logging diagnostics, and keeping track of simple transactions. So his talk is going to dive into those problems, talking about the evolution of those systems, getting to the scale they were built towards, very high volumes, with a strong bias towards cloud-hosted applications. Should be very interesting, so let's give it a listen. Chariot is sponsoring a one-day practical DevOps seminar on October 18th, 2011. Learn how to tightly integrate your development and operations experts and improve the quality and rapidity in producing your software. The one-day, $99 conference includes talks from Sonatype's Jason Van Zyl, CloudBees, Puppet Labs, and two real-world case studies from Fortune 500 companies. The show will wrap up with a panel discussion that will take your questions from each of our speakers. Don't miss this highly informative, low-cost event. More information is available at chariotsolutions.com/devops-seminar or by clicking the DevOps seminar link on techcast.chariotsolutions.com. Hope to see you there.
I wanted to do a talk about some of the maybe the less interesting things, less interesting parts of building a distributed system. Whenever I look at talks online, they're always like really neat and sexy. It's, you know, here's how you do this streaming thing with MapReduce. You know, here's all, you know, a dozen NoSQL stores that will, you know, scale arbitrarily. And when thinking about what to present, I was thinking about sort of what I've spent the last few years doing. And the hardest things were really, really boring. So I'm just telling you up front, I've got a nice, boring presentation for you. Thank you. I'm actually in sales. I have no idea what I'm talking about. So, technically. So a bit of background. I'm the chief architect for Invite Media. We were acquired by Google about a year ago. What we do is basically we buy ads, a lot of ads very quickly. I was lucky to sort of get in this position because it's one of the few times where you have to take a system that's very, very small. It's just a couple machines. And over the course of literally months, scale it up to hundreds of machines. And as the title says, it's millions of requests per minute. The stream never stops. You have to handle everything. You're dealing with money. It's a very complicated and interesting distributed system. And so here's some of the parts where some of our missteps, and they might not be specific to Invite, but more patterns of, oh, you know, we've got this problem, here's how we solve it, oh, you know, machines are melting, here's what we do, and approximately where we ended up, except without any of those juicy NDA-breaking details that I'm sure you're interested in. So the first is balancing in the sense of load balancing. Now, I'm coming from the perspective where everything's sort of running in the cloud, one cloud provider or another. So there's just right off the bat, there's no access to hardware load balancing, which would make this just a really, really short section, which is, you know, throw a couple F5s in there, and now your requests get where they need to go. So the basic problem, you have servers, requests, they need to get to servers quickly. So when this problem first came up, it's like, well, you know, we have three servers, and one server's not really enough to handle everything. It would be nice if we can get everyone to sort of distribute themselves across servers, so DNS load balancing, kind of take one there, which works well. You set up a DNS server, you know, this is all secondhand. Client asks, you know, where can I get this resource, and it just gives you a random backend, and, you know, you balance that between your three servers, and everything works out great. It's fault-tolerant in the sense that DNS servers are an easy thing to fail over. They're primarily read-only. You can put a couple out there, and it's easy to, you know, do tricks with the IP, and you don't have to worry about, you know, any sort of special rules or anything. They behave relatively well. They can operate out of memory. You have distributed request balancing in the sense that you have no choke point. You know, clients are going directly to your servers. You know, all is good in the world. And, of course, it leaves the door open for global load distribution. But, you know, right now you only have three servers, and you're wasting your time thinking about that. Meanwhile, this starts to get a little problematic. some DNS clients, not all, but some will expect the responses to come back in a single UDP packet. So once you start getting a dozen machines, well, now your UDP talk is it's a bit too big. Clients can't handle it. Other problems are, you know, it's a bit of an advantage not to have sort of this choke point in the middle, but now you can't, you know, be down for maintenance for 30 seconds. It's something you can't do because clients are going directly to your boxes. You have to box one down, box two down, box three down. So you're missing this. And another point which you all know is that with DNS, it's the time to live is pretty much arbitrary in practice. I mean, you can set short time to lives in hopes that clients ask for new IP addresses, but that's just not the case. You can't quickly bring servers offline, bring them online. So round two, try to solve this problem with software. So at the time, the way that I was familiar with doing this was using ModProxy and Apache and ProxyPass with Nginx. And this works relatively well because now you don't have you don't have 50 DNS records. You can send them right to one of these boxes. They can, you know, pick a live backend. You can put up your maintenance page. You have the single point where everything goes through. And all is good. Backend isolation where, because clients are talking to this process now, you can just seal off your backends from the outside world, which is a good thing. The problem with that is that these servers are not really designed to be load balancers. They're web servers. And in practice, there's many different ways to set up Apache or Nginx, and they will do a reasonable job at balancing requests, but once you get up in sort of the tens of thousands range, you hit the point where they'll say, you know, I'm a web server with a reverse proxy plugin. I'm not a load balancer, and these things, and you'll start to run into strange problems there. You know, one such is clients that take a long time. Clients, if they're slowly sending you data that's tying up very valuable resources on your system, you want to snap that. As far as I know, there's no easy available configuration options in those to do just sort of load balancing type tasks. So take three is HAProxy and DNS. It seems that in the past year or so, HAProxy has gotten like a lot more popular than it was. But I was happy to find this gem when I did, and it's an honest to God software load balancer, and that is what it does. That's where it is. It is extraordinarily fast. It's not doing anything it doesn't have to. The code goes through many iterations on a couple live sites. I forget what some of the bigger names are. Actually, I guess Invite Media is one of the bigger names, just traffic-wise. But but anyway, we found it to be stable. It's very, very fast. Really? No, Yahoo wrote Traffic Server. Oh, well, that code's kind of something. It's highly configurable. This is really nice with HAProxy. You can say, you know, when this request comes in, if it has this sort of header, then it's going to go to this backend. And in this backend, clients need to respond in this amount of time or snap the connection. Or, you know, it's configurable 100 different ways. If slow clients are connecting to you, you know, they're trying to tie up resources, essentially DOS you with slow connections, you can just snap them. You can say, you have to give me the full request in 100 milliseconds or this connection is just dropped. Another actually nice point about sort of in this spot is that it'll do raw TCP and HTTP too. So if you've got something where you have just some TCP service that's just stateful sockets, you can actually throw HAProxy in front of it too, and a lot of these same rules apply, and it's pretty good. By which I mean pretty, pretty good. Hugely concurrent loads. I can't tell you too much about how HAProxy is designed just because I'm ignorant, but you know, when I try and write a socket server in C, it does not handle as many concurrent connections as HAProxy does. I think what this really means is that Mark Chadwick's C code cannot handle concurrent loads. But read it however you like. And splice. I always like the splice call, and it uses splice. What that does is you've got two buffers, and so when requests are coming in and they've got to go out the other side, it's a curl call where it doesn't have to copy the memory. Cool. So one of the problems that you will run into, or you may run into with HAProxy, if you're sending it a lot of traffic very, very quickly, I won't sit here and explain these, but these are just pretty basic TCP tuning parameters that you can put on a standard Linux box. You know, if you download Ubuntu Server and you spin it up, it's going to have TCP settings that are sort of meant for like a web server or a database. In a big, you know, in a load balancer like this, you're literally you're churning through thousands and thousands of requests a second. Anything with a TW in it means time wait. That's sort of what you're doing is, you know, the operating system will leave sort of the file handles for the threads laying around after the clients get disconnected, and you want it to reuse them well and just keep things flowing well. I won't dig too deep into this, but a well-configured HA proxy on a nice OS will easily push 50,000 a second, and it can actually get higher, but 50 is a nice where you're not really maxing too much. A nice thing is that if it does get overloaded, it can actually still continue to accept requests. It has sort of like an anti-DOS thing built in where you can say, you know, once you pass this threshold, just start returning this static thing. So if you are ever really maxing out one of these proxies, you can sort of configure it to be like, you know, while I'm getting the other one up, you know, just send people over here. But that's an interesting problem to have. And that works really well. The second part is error detection. My thought here is just to go through a couple things that are tricky, not get into way too much detail, and just give a high level overview. Just really just stop me if you have any questions. It's, you know, when I've run through this, it's been 45 minutes, so I'm short anyway. Very little. One of the things that it's doing is it's keeping persistent TCP connections to the guys on the back end, so you don't have to reestablish every time. I don't know if I've ever measured it just because they've just been behind proxies for so long. Yeah, it's really nominal. You'll see that our even at 50 to 80,000 requests a second, the HA proxy process is essentially idle. I'm sure that any weight that you're incurring is just system calls and things, but even then it's nominal.
So just to make sure I'm clear, you're running HA proxy and DNS load balancing, so you have many IP addresses returned, and then
correct, yeah, we have
one of your HA proxies.
Right. There's so it's some number of pools around the globe, which DNS does the global balancing and the balancing to. One of the nice things is that the DNS will actually check those HA proxies periodically. And so if we're having problems that we just don't know about or we haven't gotten to them yet, it's sort of a best effort because, you know, like we said earlier, the time to lives are not the word of God, but it'll take them out of the pool. So yeah, so it's not the best, it's not the worst. We do traffic over SSL. And actually, S-Tunnel, just 443 is S-Tunnel, which just goes to an HA proxy. So S-Tunnel does the wrapping and unwrapping of the SSL to normal HTTP. It's a very classy solution, but it... what can you do? It gets the job done. I mean, what do you want? You want me to put a web server in front? I don't know. It works great. All right. Error detection. This is another one that's kind of tricky at a larger scale because one of the things that's not immediately obvious is once you get past a few hundred machines, what an error is starts to change a little bit. Like when you have three boxes and a box dies, it was probably the database server or something, and you know you're screaming and looking for backups and life is terrible. When you have 800 machines and a box dies, it's like, you don't even care. Like it's just like, okay, boxes die, there's 499. You're like, I'll worry about this tomorrow. It's, you know, less than 1% reduction in capacity. So what errors mean at a certain scale start to change a little bit, and it's kind of interesting. And sort of the way that you may be used to detecting errors is you can still detect them, but they don't mean as much. It's kind of weird. I'll dig into it a bit. Odds that I trip over that by the time I'm done. Pretty good. Right, so the types of errors that you see, machines fail, physical hardware failures, disks, you know, stuff like that, just relatively common. There's a 1 in 1,000 chance that a machine's going to have one of those problems in a given day, and you have 1,000 machines. You know, it's just a constant cycle of that kind of stuff happening. Code fails. I don't mean stack traces here, but one of the errors that's hard to detect is sort of subtle code bugs. You know, we were seeing, you know, over here, that when we were talking to this service, we're doing about 12,000 requests a second, but we did that code push and now we're down to 10,000 requests a second, or this is spending differently, or we're seeing more or less messages over here. And that's a very difficult thing to detect with normal monitoring solutions, because what is it? Is it a log message? It's somebody, you want to see things changing, and that's kind of a trickier thing to do. Do what? I have no comment. Infrastructure, network partitions and things. That can be an incredibly subtle one, too. If you have, a relatively well-coded client and server, you'll, sort of code around or do something in the case of a network partition. But if you're too transparent about it, it may manifest itself in interesting ways. So these are all things that you want to look at. So take one. Just log at a disk. Take a log at a disk, look at the disk. Everything's good. And that, for three machines, is a simple enough solution. You want to be able to know when things are failing, so SSH web server, tail-f, boom. And then there you go. You can see errors. You sort of can look at things happening and, this should be closer to this value and this should be closer to this value. Of course, the problems with this are, A, it's untenable, and B, sort of a lot of the more subtle things are a function of what you know. This number should be higher. This number should be lower. These are things that you can't scale this out. These are just things in your brain, and they're not really good for detecting errors once the number of things start changing. So you can sort of at least solve the problem of spending a lot of time SSHing boxes by shipping this to a log host. You run into a new set of problems there. This isn't news to anyone. You get a couple hundred servers, and the log machine will melt. If you have 5-10 things you want to log per request, 800 machines, it's just the logging infrastructure on one box won't work. So you scale it up to a few machines, and you use a distributed file system, and you just keep scaling up each component until you can get all the logs in one spot where you can finally tail them again, and it finally works. And it's completely, completely useless. At this point, things will be scrolling by. So it's a complete waste. So this is going all the way to take four. Is just to step back and think about. And I don't mean screw logging. Of course, you need to log, but think about what you're trying to do. And sort of as I was doing a half-hearted job at trying to explain earlier, on a very distributed system, the things that you care about are probably when things are changing when they shouldn't be changing. Throughput ticks down here. You're suddenly seeing more or less of something here that correlates to something else. So I'm not saying this is a terribly integrated solution, but you can just count things. You can count things and graph things. And a great thing to do is just as your application is running, just dump metrics to a thing that can slurp up metrics and show you graphs. Have those graphs always display, and you can, it doesn't have a lot of automation to it, but you'd be surprised how many different problems can manifest themselves in just graphs of, latency, throughput. You take a handful of metrics, you throw them up on a screen, and you'll see two of them will drop at the same time, and you start sitting there, and what is going on there? And that's actually where a lot of the real subtle bugs come from.
Do you have a particular county graphing thing that you like?
So we have a particular county graphing thing that we like. Thank you. It's on the next page. Keep up. Cool, so Graphite works well, and we use Graphite a lot. One of the problems, didn't always have that one of the problems, but is Graphite is not the fastest piece of software in the world, which is, it's no fault of Graphite. It's actually a pretty well-designed system where you have these little Python agents and, these talk to these and these talk to these. And these little agents that sit around are, once you get past a dozen or so machines, they just can't keep up. The default format to sort of talk to Graphite is this line-oriented socket thing. And if you've ever done high-volume network program, you know that just about the last format you ever want to use is line-oriented, because every single buffer. You've got to look at every single byte as it's coming in before you can pass it to somebody to deal with. But that's what they choose. Internally, they use sort of a length field and a pickle thing. So to get around that problem, I just whipped this up like relatively recently. It's like a little Netty. Netty is a NIO Java network library thing. It does things asynchronously. And all that really does is it slurps up the line delimited metrics very quickly, converts them to sort of the pickle format, and but it uses a consistent hash to push it out to a set of graphite nodes. And that works relatively well. That does probably 300,000 metrics a second. Cool. And one of the things they added to Graphite recently, which this actually helps a lot, is you're writing just a lot of things to disk. Each metric you want to keep is its own fixed length file. You know, you're sending a ton of metrics. So they added federated storage, which is to say I'm going to have n hosts, and it's up to me to decide which metrics go to which hosts. And the UI, then when you're making a graph, will sort of take a quick poll of everybody and aggregate it together. It's not quite scatter gather, but it's close enough. And that actually, given the volume of it, works relatively well. We have probably 25 machines doing Graphite. And you know, it'd be nice to rewrite it to be a little bit quicker and not use flat files and this and that, but that's good enough, and it detects a lot of errors. Pixelated sunshine. Cool, the other type of monitoring would be, you know, what you would use Xenos, yeah. Yeah, that does take a bit of intuition, where I said, you know, it was bad to keep this knowledge just in your head. But when you have just graphs, that does take intuition. Graphite has an API, of course, where you can sort of query these things. And there are a lot of automated scripts which will then ask Graphite, like, how things are going. But for one where you just notice an anomaly, it usually is pulling up more and more graphs. We'll have a lot of things aggregated. That's another thing that Relay will do, is it'll just, like, you can give it patterns and it'll bulk up these big aggregations. So you're generally looking at aggregations. So then you split apart these aggregations and be like, you know, what sorts of servers is this happening on, or what sorts of requests? Like, try and find a limiting set of conditions, and then it's just onto the unit test to see if you can figure out what's going on. But actually, it's really, really rarely the code. It's almost always infrastructure. So that, you know, then that's your normal set of debugging tools. You know, increase latency here. Let's see what the network's doing. That's good. Taking up some time. Cool. So Xenos, if you're not familiar, it's just a really, you know, just standard sort of infrastructure monitoring. You know, here's what my disks are doing. You know, here's what my NICs look like. Here's a machine that's gone down. And Graphite's really not good at that kind of thing, and Xenos is just, you know, it's the run-of-the-mill thing that does that. And Xenos will get pretty toasty with hundreds of machines. It is doing a lot. It has a MySQL database. It has, like, all of, like, 50 little Python scripts that do all these things. It's calling out to all these different places. It's building these RRD files. There are a lot of things going on a Graphite host. And so I remember digging into this as this starts getting kind of hairy, and it's like, well, you know, like, we'll move the MySQL thing over here, and we'll get a distributed sort of a shared file system here, and we'll put those over there and, like, have a thing run. And so we just bought a really big machine, and that works great. So that'll a nice big box. You take one of EC2's biggest offerings, you put Xenos on it, it'll handle 1,000 machines. Just there you go. Problem solved. That is my favorite one. Moving data. Sort of to describe the problem here, generally, if you're doing this sort of volume where it's, you know, many millions of requests per minute, you're not, the output of your application isn't, I don't mean this always holds true, but your output of the application is you're not really writing things to the database or things like that. You wouldn't be able to find a database that could handle it. So if you're emitting sort of small notes of transaction, this happened, this happened, this happened, and another system sort of can deal with with taking care of those. And I've seen that a few times. I don't know particularly how common it is, but it's common enough, and it's kind of a tricky problem because you have two decoupled systems, and they're sending messages over the wire, and it's a really important part of your system. You don't want to lose any messages, and they're high-volume messages. Right, so, yep, you may need to store them somewhere. I'll make that assumption on your behalf. Cool. Take one. You're welcome. Transaction records are published. Subscribers want to, you know, subscribe to them. So PubSub. So this is, I don't mean to like every time like walk in the middle of the room like scratch my head, but I think that is what I'll do. This is kind of tricky. And from what I've seen, in the open source messaging buses are not quite designed to I'm really watching my words here. It's a really high volume for them to handle, and it's not really the classic case of pub sub where you've got topics and, you know, certain people are interested in topics. It's like you've got a crap ton of data here which needs to get over here pretty snappy. It doesn't have to, there's no, you know, real-time constraints on it, but it has to happen relatively quickly. So it could be incompetence, but going through a couple iterations with open source message buses, they melted. They would just melt once you get into about 6 digits request per second. You have many small messages, and they have so many features that, you know, that are meant for different types of things where they just could not handle this sort of load. It was an impedance mismatch of tools. So take two, we could probably cut out this middleman. If we're generating a lot of data on this end and we know it needs to get to this end, then there's no need to really go through anything. We'll just use RPC. The problem that you may run into here is that managing all those connections is kind of a tricky thing. We're assuming about the order of 1,000 boxes here, and these people, you guys who are emitting things, have to deal with TCP connections getting snapped, clients going down, what to do when a client goes down, how many consumers might want this data, and you start building up a lot of code on both sides to make sure this huge quantity of tiny little messages makes it from here to here, and things start getting very, very complicated for how to move these around. And right, so one of the problems, of course, is just the sheer quantity of messages. You have many very, very small messages, which is never a particularly easy thing to send, do with some I/O operation. You really want to bulk these up. So a bit of investigation. Used a really fancy spooling thing called appending to a file. And this is a nice, fancy solution. So let me describe this distributed, just fault-tolerant message queue to you. Write something to a file, copy it to a host. It works relatively well. It can be incredibly high throughput, more so than any other offering kind of just sort of looked at. You would not believe how much just sheer quantity of messages compared to other types of solutions you can sort of send through this distributed messaging queue. And the thing I really like about this is that it's embarrassingly trivial. Like, this isn't cool. This is writing to a file and shipping it over the wire. Like, it's the least cool thing, but it works great. Yeah?
What are you using to make a copy?
Make the copy?
Yeah, to copy it over the host. Jeez.
Yeah,
no. That's what I was curious, but is it?
It actually pushes it to S3. So, push to S3. So, it actually, you don't even need to know where the consumers are, so you sort of push to S3. People pull from S3. Of course, you have eventual consistency problems, but you know it will eventually get there with some number of nines. Some number of nines that are better than I could do. Cool. So I wanted to take a brief interlude because sometimes I'm very bad at, when looking at a problem like this, figuring out what things are going to look like at the end of the day. I always want to kind of be like, oh yeah, we'll just throw servers at it. Like, nobody worry about anything. And it's sometimes I lose that sense of estimating and practicality. Or maybe I've heard of people who have, not me. So this always kind of blows my mind. 10,000 requests a second, not that much. It's a lot for a web app, but it's not a terrible amount for somebody who's just sitting there, you know, idle, not idly, but it's okay. It doesn't blow your socks off. 1K of logging. Each request, you know, you've got something, you've got to move someplace else, 1K of logging. That's 10 megabytes a second. That's what, 5-6 floppy disks? That's a lot. got the youngins in here. So it's the better part of a terabyte a day. And the first two numbers really don't impress me. Maybe my intuition's just bad, but it's like, oh, yeah, that's fine. Don't worry about it. But you can have there's actual problems that creep up. Once you start seeing, okay, terabyte per day, it's like, okay, now there are things I need to think about. And most of these constraints can be solved. It's like, okay, so I'll flood the NIC on this card, so we'll sort of distribute it across these two machines, send it out over there. But there are some interesting bottlenecks that you may run into. With small cloud providers, literally DC bandwidth. And this is a very difficult thing to get around while staying on the same smallish cloud provider. They may not, because they probably lease from somebody else, they're either in some colo or some cage somewhere, they may not be able to get enough bandwidth for you to move this out of the data center to where it needs to go. That is a very inflexible problem. That is a very difficult thing to deal with. And disk bandwidth. Regardless if you're using virtualization or other things, at some point, especially if this is all going to one spot, there's a magnetic disk somewhere which needs to write all this stuff fast enough to make it on that disk. And once you cross that, you need to shuffle things around because you'll really start destroying things. Those are, I always thought, were really interesting sort of ceilings. Along these lines, something that I'm not great at remembering is if you store everything, when your traffic is constant, your storage increases linearly. Day one, you hold day one. Day two, you hold day two and day one. And so, of course, if your traffic increases more than linearly, well, then you've got a serious problem. So if you start seeing, assuming that you're storing all these things, which I would hope you are, I mean, they're records of transaction for your business, when you start seeing the hockey stick, it might be a good time early to think about data retention plans because it's, that ends up being an awful lot of data after not much time. So we're moving flat files over the wire. This seems to be working pretty well. But if we could chop an order of magnitude off transmission time, storage costs, I guess those would really be the only two. I guess we don't have to worry about NIC throughput at this point. That would be great. It would sort of give us the extra breathing room. And it turns out that you can do that really easily and cheaply. And it's called GZIP. It's this incredible technology for when you're doing anything over the wire. Sometimes it's not entirely obvious, especially if you're making requests or just dumping to files or things. GZIP is such an optimized operation. Just do it. Just do it. Measure it and do it, but probably just do it. You can sit, especially with distributed network operations, if you're doing anything over the wire, GZIPing will probably be more time savings for your system as a whole than any one optimization that you can do anywhere in your code. It's an incredible time saver and space saver in distributed systems, and there are very, very few spots where I would say don't use it. I guess the exception would be very small pieces of data where your overhead is then bigger than your compression. But it's almost free. It saves enormous amount of time when doing I/O. Just throwing it out there. That works pretty well. I think this is the last section on deploying. Cool. So this of course gets a little tricky. I guess we'll assume hundreds of machines. I guess this some of these things start even coming true much sooner. So what's weird when you have hundreds of machines is, maybe canary in code would be a better place to start. A good way to sort of vet things. You always have this stream of traffic coming in. It never stops. It's relentless. It is high volume. When you want to push code out, a nice thing might be to take a small subset of your servers, push code to them, watch how they behave. And there's a risk that you run there which is that, you know, the new version isn't compatible with the old version. It could be that new machines log in one format and old machines log in another format, or, you know, a terrible one is, you know, this machine talks to with the client, or let's say it sets a cookie one way, and then when next time the client makes a request, then it's going to a machine that can't read the cookie. There are all sorts of compatibility problems you can have here. And it's a good thing to start early, because after a relatively small number of machines, no deploy is ever atomic. Really, after one machine, no deploy is ever atomic. And if you do this on purpose up front, you can save yourself just an awful lot of headache. I swear that's not from experience. Something else you see is, of course, cascading failures. Everybody here knows about that. You know, you upgrade a load balancer, which shifts the load to the remaining load balancers. One of them gets over capacity and dies, and suddenly everything's dead. When you have sort of this volume of traffic, an important thing to always note is for whatever you're fiddling with, know what its capacity is and what its capacity is going to be when you're fiddling with it. It's just get it tattooed right on the arm. Cross-version interactions we talked about. Global deployments, this is a fun one. If you use a deployment system that's sort of, I don't know if this is true, but let's say if you're pulling code that, you know, each file is a new TCP connection and you've got, you know, thousands of files. I doubt that's true, but let's say you're using a system like that. The thing to keep conscious is, of course, if you're doing this in one data center, it works well enough. If you do this around the globe, you incur a certain amount of latency per connection, which now, if you're deploying, pushing lots of small files out there, can accumulate to an awful lot of latency. It's just it's a bizarre, interesting thing. So you take one at this is essentially just go on each code, update the source, and restart. Works well enough, especially for a small number of machines. I can't really think of a better way to do that. It's fast, and really, you just don't care about other stuff yet. And this sort of seems to be the normal progression, where it's once this doesn't work, you sort of look at the tools like Capistrano, and there's that Python one. Fabric. And those actually work really well up to, you know, a few dozen nodes. One of the time savings you can fix with parallelization or things like that, but the real big problems are you now need to move an awful lot of data, like off your laptop, over your connection into the cloud to end servers, and that can be a serious bottleneck. The other one is once you get past, you know, a handful of machines, how do you know that there's a failure? What do you do on a failure? If you're saying, do this to a machine, and the machine says, well, there was an error, how do you converge on the correct state? Often when pushing out commands like this, failures they're hard to detect, but when you can detect them, when you're at the end of a deployment, what does it mean? What is your state? If there was an error on three of the machines, what state are those machines in? Can you go back to them? Do you need to fix them by hand? For a large number of machines, this can get complicated. So the way that the common step three is use a deployment system. And sort of the gist here is that you tell the deployment system, look, I've programmed out how to converge on the state of the next release. And clients will say, you know, okay, great. They'll contact the deployment system. The deployment system will sort of ship them code and be like, here's how you converge on the next release. And it'll be a sequence of steps they can do. And if something fails, it'll retry or, you know, send you errors. And it's most of the time, if there's an intermittent error, then it'll just get it the next time because it describes how to converge on a state. But, you know, you could still have the problem where there's a permanent error with a host. And at that point, usually these guys will alert you. CF Engine won't. Puppet, there's something you can use on top of Puppet to do this. I forget the name. Right, cool, sweet, Chef has the node lists and things, and you can definitely make sure that if a node takes an action when it's done a successful deploy, you can write something to make sure that they'll deploy. One of the problems is this puts a lot of strain on these deploy machines, because now, especially if they're in the same data center, you know, many, many hosts can ask the deploy machine for code. In the case of Chef, it can perform searches, which is now going into like some other database, and it doesn't take much to overwhelm the host. The only one I can speak in depth about is here is Chef. So the next step then is sort of to break out the Chef components. Again, I don't have a lot of experience with Puppet, but I've dug into the code a little bit, and I'm forgetting the name of the thing that goes on top of it that's the web app. But the really nice thing about Chef is that when you hit this point, it's made up of a bunch of small components, and that's not all of them. And some of them, like the web UI, that takes a fair pounding, you can just pull off onto other machines. Get a machine for the CouchDB machine, a couple machines for the RabbitMQ server. The Solr indexer is a little process that's sitting there sort of building up indexes for clients to search on. And you can sort of break this out into however many machines it needs to be on to make you stop melting. Galaxy? What? I think that's right. No, I think that's a great idea. And that's actually, there's no reason you can't do that with Chef. You can say, there's actually the applications resource where you can say, here's this thing, you know, manage this, and there's nothing preventing you from shipping a tarball. I think if I was going to do that, I don't think I'd use Chef, because it does not have the world's fastest web server on it, and moving that giant tarball through Chef. But yeah, you can follow that pattern, and that certainly helps with the cross DC deployment. So, reaching the end of the trail here. Here we go. This isn't news. I guess I was thinking about this earlier this morning. Earlier this morning you can tell how much prep I did. And I was trying to think about like what the thing that like really saved my bacon the most times where relatively okay, I'll abort that sentence. But the thing that saved my bacon the most times while sort of very rapidly scaling up this system, and more times than not, when things broke, and things broke subtly, they never really were what I thought they were. Things never broke sort of how I would expect them to. If it's like, well, I'm going to build this server, and it's going to do this, it would probably do that thing just fine, and then it would break over here, and it, you know, okay. And it's sometimes really difficult to figure out where, you know, big distributed components are breaking. And the one thing that I think helped me the most was just way on like the cusp of my memory was that operating systems class in college. And it's surprising where at the time I was like, oh, you know, this is kind of boring. But, you know, as these systems grow bigger and bigger and bigger, like the sequence of a TCP handshake start making sense. Because now you've got to look at them at a huge scale and figure out why they're not working. You know, how the kernel is scheduling writes to disk is very, very important when your disks are melting. All these things that just sort of a 101 operating systems class. I think that's the thing that saved my bacon the most times. Any questions? Thanks.
Thanks to Mark Chadwick for coming out and speaking this year at ATE. Sign up for our news and events emails and you'll be in the know. Head over to chariotsolutions.com/newsletter-signup and fill out the form. We'll send you regular newsletters that include technology news, podcast and blog and screencast links, and information about our upcoming events. The URL again is chariotsolutions.com/newsletter-signup. We'll also post it on our TechCast site, techcast.chariotsolutions.com.